Welcome back to Canucks Talk. Josh Elliott-Wolf, Thomas Drantz here with you. Coming to you live from the Kintext studio. You can text in 650-650 on the Dunbar Lumber text line. Canucks Talk is brought to you by Rack Steel. Rack Steel offers industry-leading heli forklifts and engineered racking solutions. Visit them online at racksteel.com. It is Canucks Talk. Josh Elliott-Wolf, Thomas Drantz here with you. We briefly touched on one of tonight's Stanley Cup playoff games, game two between the Edmonton Oilers and Vegas Golden Knights. But we haven't spoken about last night's games. Game two between the Leafs and Panthers, the Toronto Maple Leafs. They take a 2-0 series lead, Drantz.
Yeah, they look good.
They look good. Are they like, is this the first time I've been like, man, they might be for real.
Yeah. And the Panthers had a pretty significant push when you see their fastball. They're scary, really scary. I thought they turned up in the last two periods and the Leafs were just kind of hanging on for dear life. They won on a Mitch Marner goal that I'm pretty confident was an attempted dump in. Like, I'm pretty sure that was a shot.
It was a weird one.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure that shot was designed to go into the corner, which is just funny because it's like, you know, if I was to ask you, who's the NHL version of James Harden? I feel like Mitch Marner would be high on people's lists.
It feels apt.
Of responses. And, you know, it's like you play enough playoff games and eventually you get the sick, you know, stranglehold in a series game winner off of what I think was, it was either shooting for just like a rebound or trying to put it into the corner for your teammates to skate onto, eludes Sergei Bobrovsky. 2-0 series lead for the Maple Leafs, who now, you know, just need to avoid losing two. Like, I mean, they can lose one of the next five. Sorry, they need to win two of the next five to advance.
Yeah,
to the conference final.
Yeah,
where they'll have like a serious path.
The Toronto Maple Leafs.
No.
After last night, I think at the very least, Canucks fans need to begin to mentally prepare themselves for the possibility.
Nope.
Of a Toronto-Edmonton Stanley Cup final.
Not going to happen. That
sounds so bad.
See, I think it sounds thrilling.
Yeah, but you're a sicko, man.
Do you know how engaged this country will be around that? Like,
who do you want to see lose then in that series?
I think no matter what, we're all winners.
Everyone's going to have fun out there. It's going to be a good time.
Who do I want to see lose? Can they both lose? It's like, and the continuous overtime in Game 7 of the Stanley Cup Final has continued into the year 2036.
We talked about this yesterday, though. Like, which team would you hate to see win more than that, too?
Yeah, my like, team chaos outcome in like, my super imaginary world.
Who would I hate to see win more than the Leafs? I'm now, like, thinking about it really seriously.
It's really tough.
For me, I would, if it was the Oilers and Leafs, I would want the Leafs to win. Because ultimate chaos is if McDavid can't break through in Edmonton, eventually one day he requests a trade. If they win in Edmonton, he doesn't have to
request a trade. He can just
walk.
Yeah, he can just walk in a year. Like he's extension eligible on July 1st, right? So,
but then do you run the risk of McDavid going to Toronto?
I think if he wins, he'll have considered the business attended to.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Like, I mean, either way.
Yeah.
Either way, it's bad.
Either way, McDavid's Oilers future is going to be a huge story to track. I want to see Connor McDavid win one.
I do too, just not with the Edmonton Oilers.
I was talking to some buddies last night while I was watching the game, the Leafs-Panthers game, and they were talking about how, you know, when you watch that Four Nations final, it's so clear that, like, MacKinnon and McDavid and Makar are, like, you know, three of the best players in the world. And I was saying, you know, I think the gap between Austin Matthews, who just blended in that Four Nations final, and Nathan MacKinnon is far, far narrower than the gap between Nathan MacKinnon and Connor McDavid. Like, I think Connor McDavid is the best player on the planet, and I think there's, like, a big gap between him and Nathan MacKinnon, who I'd pick second.
I think certainly when McDavid is at, like, full power in the Four Nations, he wasn't necessarily at full McDavid level.
No, he wasn't.
Like, we didn't see peak McDavid there, but we see it often in the playoffs.
I don't think we saw it all season.
No, definitely. This was an off season for McDavid.
But we saw it in the playoffs last year, mm-hmm. and we're seeing it right now. And I mean, I just think when you watch like that comeback in the comeback that came short, that fell short in game one against the Los Angeles Kings of that first round series, and what he did in the final 10 minutes. And actually, I was thinking about it watching the Panthers chase that game yesterday, right, where they're down one with 3 minutes to go and they're getting all these chances, but then they're like shifting their defensemen, but Barkov's staying on, right? And you can just tell that he's run out of gas. And it's like the thing about McDavid is he's like 2.5 minutes into a shift and he's still capable of like outskating a fresh defender, putting them absolutely not just like in his back pocket, but clearing them by a stride or two and then going in on net and doing something completely impossible.
It's kind of the Quinn Hughes element where it's like he's been out there for 3 minutes and it looks like he just got out there.
Except it's at even another level.
Yeah.
It's at even another level beyond that. And Quinn Hughes looks like he can play all day.
Mm-hmm.
Look, I love watching Connor McDavid. I'm sorry. I'm not going to apologize for it. I feel there are very few athletes in your life that you are like, wow, I got to witness this. You know what I mean? Like, I feel lucky to witness it. When I go cover a game that Connor McDavid's playing in against the Canucks, I'm like excited because it feels elevated, special, and I want to see him win a cup. I do. I'm not going to lie. I just want to see greatness succeed. I want to root for greatness. I want to enjoy greatness. I would like to see Connor McDavid win a cup as just a neutral hockey fan who thinks that he's like not just head and shoulders, but like head, shoulders, and elbows above everyone else playing the game today.
I do think it would be hockey is like the one, no, maybe not the one sport because you see it in baseball too. But hockey is a sport where you can be, like you mentioned, a player who's so head and shoulders above everyone else in the game and still. The question of if you're going to win a championship is like kind of up in the air. It does feel inevitable that at some point McDavid will probably break through the Oilers, especially if they're just going to roll with McDavid and Draisaitl for a long time. You're going to get your chances at a cup, but it's not like basketball, you know, where it's like, well, LeBron's going to win some championships and he can do it on his own. He's done it on his own, essentially. I know basketball Ben would disagree with me, but it's not the same with McDavid, right? It would feel like a shame if he didn't get it done at some point, because I do think when we talk about the most frustrating thing when we talk about a player's legacy, especially in hockey or a sport that's not basketball, is, oh, they never won, so we can't count them at the same echelon of other players that are top five, top 10, whatever it is.
Well, think about what happened with Ovechkin, right? It took ages for him to get his cup.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, will he get it?
Yeah. And like,
but it mattered that he did.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly.
You just have to get one in hockey. That's the thing. You get one and then it's fine. And people are still, they're always going to consider Connor McDavid one of the best players to ever play the game. It's undeniable, but you do have to get one. I still don't know if it's this year. I'm not convinced, because I think even if they make it through, like, Dallas to me is a better team.
Maybe if they get Heiskanen back and he's 100%.
Yeah.
I mean, I think Dallas is a flawed team that's being carried by a top end that is just dominant at the moment. Completely dominant. Well, the Oilers are too, except the Oilers have it better. Like, the Oilers have that top gear, but higher.
But I also think, if both top gears are equal, which, like, they
they're
won't,
not.
They won't
they're not.
Be.
They're not close to equal, though. That's the point. Like, no one can hit against McDavid right now.
Yeah, but I don't know. I don't know. I think the Stars are a deeper team that can at least, and they have a goalie like Ottinger.
They just beat a deeper team. Like, they just beat a deeper team. You know, the truth is that the Avalanche are far better composed. What does that right side of the blue line, if Haskinen's not 100%, look like against McDavid and Draisaitl and that new look RNH Hyman line? Like, I don't know, man. I don't think the Dallas Stars are good enough defensively to hang with what the Oilers can throw at them.
I mean, they just beat like Nathan MacKinnon, Cale Makar, and the Avalanche, who are also like
right. because
high powered team.
Because Mikko Rantanen went completely nuke.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's awesome, but the Oilers have the greater arsenal of nukes. Like, the triumph of the Dallas Stars in the playoffs to this point is a reflection of a team that, having been through the playoffs and had success, deep runs, Stanley Cup final appearances as one of those Stryver class, deep, well-built clubs, right? That ultimately would bump into Kucherov or would bump into Eichel or would bump into one of those transcendent players, bumped into McDavid last year, mm-hmm. right? Decided, hey, we better get our own transcendent top gear player. And that's worked for them. And in fact, disguised massive, significant holes in their lineup.
I don't, where, what, like, the only holes in their lineup to me are the right side.
That's a huge hole, man. That,
yeah, but the Oilers
name the right
also
side of their
holes.
Defense. They're playing Cody Ceci top pair. They're playing Ilya Labushkin top mm-hmm. 4 minutes.
Yeah, I'm not saying it's
they're playing
good.
Alex Petrovich.
But the Oilers, like, if you look at their lineup, too, it's not like they're without holes. It's just McDavid and Draisaitl are so crazy that it overpowers everything.
It's because we shouldn't be worried at all about the composition of these lineups relative to the speed that these teams can hit when fully dialed up. Like, their top speed matters more than the composition of the engine these days. That's the league that we've come into as a result of a 900. I mean, look at these games, man. It's like, even in the playoffs now, it's 5-4, it's 4-3. Games are impossible to kill. We have all these crazy comebacks, like right till the wire of that Leafs-Florida game. Florida looked 50-50 to score and tie it up. Right? Yeah. I mean, these games are free-flowing. These are not 2-1 games. This is not the Stanley Cup playoffs that, like, the Daryl Sutter LA Kings used to grind their way through. Right? Like, this is not that league anymore. This is the league where you need Mikko Rantanen going off. You need Connor McDavid going off. Like, you need that next tier, that next level of superstar performance to hang with those teams that can bring that. And no one brings that like the Oilers. Like, the reason to believe in Dallas is still a reason to prefer the Oilers. Do you see what I'm saying? Like,
I guess the point I'm making is there's clearly a star difference between, you know, McDavid and Draisaitl are just at their peak going to be better than even Mikko Rantanen when he's playing like he is. Well, if he's playing like he has the last two games, it's hard to be better than Mikko Rantanen in the last two games. But what I'm saying is, even like, so there's that gap between like the Oilers superstars being better than the Stars superstars. But then after that, if you look at the rest of the top six for both teams or the rest of the top nine for both teams, I think the Stars clearly outclass the Oilers. And I just think it's as good as McDavid and Draisaitl can be, they can win a series on their own. They might do it against the Dallas Stars. I just think that the second punch, third punch from the Stars, to me, is better than what the Oilers have, and it outweighs the gap between the Stars for me.
Maybe
at the top of the lineup.
Maybe. I mean, that second punch didn't matter against the Avs, right? That second punch didn't matter against Winnipeg. Like, we haven't seen a second punch thrown by the Stars in a week, and they've kept winning games because of what Rantanen's doing and Hintz are doing and Wyatt Johnston's doing. So, like, right now anyway, the Oilers have that second punch going. It was the Hyman, Ryan Nugent-Hopkins, Evander Kane line that, like, made the difference for them against Vegas, mm-hmm. that made the difference for them as that Kings series went along. Like, I don't even think you're right, necessarily, that the secondary punch that the Stars can throw is greater than what the Oilers have right now. So, yeah, I mean,
it also, for me, like, it depends on what Jason Robertson, it was his first game back.
Sure.
If he can get to
Haskinen.
A level. And Haskinen.
Yeah, but yeah, I mean, you're right. Jason Robertson is really, really good. And Miro Haskinen would slot everything a little bit differently for Dallas. I mean, Edmonton's down Ekholm, too. We're probably not getting him back this playoffs, so that's a little bit different. But yeah, I mean, I don't see an argument for why Edmonton wouldn't be the standalone Stanley Cup favorite at this point. I think they should be. I'll be picking them over Dallas if that's in fact how the cookie crumbles. Both teams are only up 1-0. There's a lot of road to run before we're in the Western Conference final. Mm-hmm. But right now, anyway, the Stanley Cup favorites are Dallas plus 300, the Hurricanes plus 360, the Oilers plus 400. And I just think that's wrong. I think the Oilers represent by far the best value on the board there.
650, 650. We got a text. Oh, did I lose it? Troy from Cloverdale The Stars were allegedly deeper last year, according to everyone. The Oilers won. The Oilers are way better this year. The Stars a little bit better. People love to hate on the Oilers. They're scary better than they were last year. I kind of think last year's version of the Oilers was better than this year's version, personally. What do you like? If you're comparing last year's Oilers to this year's Oilers, which team do you think is better set to go? Like they obviously made it to Game 7 of the Cup Final last year. Do you think this team is improved on last year's team?
This year's Stars team?
Oilers.
No, I don't. Mm-hmm. I think last year's Oilers team was materially faster, and I think that helped them a lot. And I think they had a healthy Ekholm.
Yeah, that's a big part.
So, no, I don't think that this team is better. This Oilers version is better than last year's Oilers. And I think last year's Oilers were pretty damn unlucky to not win. To be totally honest with you, I mean, I think they outplayed the Panthers in 5 of 7 games in that Stanley Cup final and lost Game 7 by a goal. I think that's like that Game 3 loss in Edmonton and that Game 1 loss in Florida were both deeply unfortunate. Or the result, like Game 1 was Oilers shooters kind of flubbed it. They kept shooting low on Bobrovsky, who struggles when you shoot high. And then Game 3, they were just genuinely unlucky to fall behind 0-3. And then once they turned up, my God, right? Like you could just see it sort of shift. And then they did an immaculate job in Game 7 as I think McDavid ran out of gas. I think there is a big difference, though. Game 1 against the Canucks, Oilers-Canucks, you remember Leon Draisaitl left the game for an extended stretch?
Yeah.
I think he was severely hurt from then on.
He didn't look right for the rest of the playoffs.
He didn't look right for the rest of the playoffs. He still managed to be such a dog because mm-hmm. he's such a competitor and he's such a great player. And obviously that shot is just so dynamic. But I think he was gutting it out. And I don't think he was. And right now I think Draisaitl, you're seeing Draisaitl at 100%. And yeah. I think that's a huge difference between last year's Oilers and this year's Oilers. And I think that's largely why people are, you know, looking at this as like a deeper, more complete Oilers team. And it's like, no, man, I just think they've got both of their most important engines running at full strength.
Yeah.
That's my view of it.
And anyway, the worry for me going into it was about Connor McDavid. I was like, you know what? Maybe he's hurt or like, I don't know what's going on because his regular season wasn't as good as it usually is. But yeah, then you get to the playoffs and he's still Connor McDavid.
Yeah. We've got a text in, by the way, that the more Drance talks about a team's fastball, the more I think the Canucks need to rebuild, lacking so much upside. And look, I think about this a lot in terms of speed or in terms of a race or in terms of a fastball. Like I'm always trying to work on these analogies because the way that I sort of think about like expected goals or some of the hockey analytics that we prize, Corsi 4 or whatever, whatever metric you prefer. What I'm really looking for and what I really think is important to try and understand in terms of how we talk about teams, right, is that like it's not about finding an all-in-one number that just like sort of speaks for us. What I do think is interesting is trying to come up with a way of measuring a team's like ability to generate more, right? Because that's what hockey really is about, right? It's not a game of raw numbers. It's not a singular engagement repetitively held. It's like a free-flowing dynamic game in an enclosed space in which one team's ability to like outpossess, outshoot, out-generate in terms of scoring chances, win more battles, attempt more entries, execute on more entries, right? Like what you're just trying to do is slowly but surely out-generate your opponent. And I think thinking of it in terms of like a top speed, like thinking about a team's expected goals number as not representing like, you know, I often talk about it as true talent, right? But but really it's like, what's your top speed? Mm-hmm. When you're trailing in a game, when it's 2-0 in the, or 3-1 in the third period of, you know, a game 7, like it was for both the Stars and the Winnipeg Jets last weekend, what's your ability when you turn up, your ceiling case, the absolute balls to the wall version of your team? What speed can you hit and how dangerous can you be relative to your opponents? And more than anything, it's like there's a million ways to win. Like you can win a game of hockey with extraordinary discipline, extraordinary finishing luck, really good defense. Like there's, you can win 2-0. You can win 7-0. You can win a crazy game where you score 2 6-on-5 goals and then win it in overtime on a deflection. Like, there's a million ways to win a hockey game. But the thing that I think we're always trying to measure and understand, especially with a view toward what matters at this time of year, is like, what attributes, what's your top speed as a team? Because so often we get into the second round of the playoffs and all of these teams are great. There's no pretenders left. And it comes down to which teams can solve for the inevitable, like, chaotic missteps that occur to you over the course of a playoff run. Which team can pull themselves out of a ditch? You need to be able to do that if you're going to win 16 games in this environment over 2.5 months against the absolute best teams in the league. And there's three teams, for to me, that just have the highest speed. And it's the Oilers. It's the Panthers. Despite being down 2-0, like, we're going to see that team's top speed over the next week, and it's going to be terrifying for Maple Leafs fans. I promise you that.
And I will say, despite having a top speed, you can still, like,
screw it up.
Yeah, it can go sideways rather quickly.
Well, you can get bad goaltending. You can get unlucky. You can get injured. You know, like, there's a million different ways for this to go. Like, the Canucks in 2011 had the highest top speed in the league.
Yeah.
And you could tell, but ultimately, over time, injuries, physical play, Boston Bruins defense, Tim Thomas's weird goaltending style, the way those games were called, all sort of conspired to the point where they lost. And they lost handily in that seventh game. Like, it wasn't close. So, you know, top speed guarantees nothing. But I do think it's the attribute that, like, I'm most interested in tracking and measuring, and it's why sort of fastballs and this idea of an upside case always matters to me. And it's sort of why, even in the playoffs last year, with all the momentum and all the smart organization that the Canucks had, like, I was pretty confident that they weren't going to be able to find that offensive gear they needed to overcome issues, to overcome, you know, a deficit in Game 6 in Edmonton or a deficit in Game 7, although I guess they got relatively close against the Oilers. You know, the truth is that they had, like, 32 shots and scored 3 goals in 2 games with a shot to advance to the conference final. And it's like, that was always their profile. They were always kind of punching above their weight and just, like, managing these great escapes 6-on-5, as opposed to being a team capable of dictating offensively against an elite side. That's what I'm looking for. And so anyway, Edmonton,
Florida
and Carolina. Those are the teams with the highest top speed, which is not to say that they're going to win, but it is to say that until those teams are out, I'm going to be picking them the rest of the way.
Fair enough. 650-650. Dunbar Lumber text line. Keep the texts coming in there. We'll get into more playoff talk as the show goes on, more Abby Canucks talk, and more. On the other side, Adam Kierzenblatt is going to join us. We'll get into some Canucks talk and maybe some Abby Canucks talk as well, as their playoff series continues. They're up 2-1 on the Coachella Valley Firebirds with a chance to win the series tomorrow night in Abbotsford. It is Canucks Talk. Josh Elliott, Wolf, Thomas Drance on Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk. Josh Elliott, Wolf, Thomas Drance here with you, coming to you live from the Kintec studio. Kintec Footwear and Orthotics working together with you in step. You can text in 650-650 on the Dunbar Lumber text line. Metro Vancouver's trusted choice for contractors and reno warriors for over 50 years. Visit them at one of their 3 locations to serve you, or online at dunbarlumber.com. It is Canucks Talk. I'm Josh, filling in for Jamie. No Canucks brunch today or tomorrow. One thing we've been doing, though, on Fridays that you just got a taste of is Treat Fridays. But Lena's not here tomorrow, so we made it a Treat Thursday.
Oh, that's why I got a Nanaimo bar pre-show.
Exactly. Nanaimo bars.
A welcome addition to my day, by the way.
Nanaimo bars might be my favorite dessert.
Yeah, they're awesome.
Top tier. They're awesome. I know some people are anti-coconut. You guys can get out of here. It's just an awesome, awesome dessert.
I mean, I don't really think of it as being very coconut forward, to be totally honest with you.
Anytime I've talked to someone who is anti-Nanaimo bar, it's because of the coconut.
Mm.
I think. Yeah. Yeah. Unless I'm misremembering. There's coconut in Nanaimo bars, right? I'm not wrong.
I don't understand people who don't like stuff.
Yeah.
I don't think there's a single food item that I, like, really don't like. Cilantro. You know, are you a cilantro guy?
No, I love cilantro.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, cilantro makes Mexican food much better.
The only thing I don't like, I will adamantly say I don't like, is grilled peppers.
What?
Specifically, I like raw peppers.
Wow,
like raw peppers in a salad.
You don't like the caramelized deliciousness?
No.
Wow.
That's a crazy
thing. Something about the texture. Something about the texture just doesn't work for me.
Man, I literally can't think of anything better. You know those like little baby peppers that are more expensive than buying normal peppers? And
yeah,
you throw like a whole bunch of them on the grill just like...
With kebabs? So good.
Cover them in some oil. Throw a little bit of salt on there. It doesn't need much. Unbelievable. Maybe my single favorite food item is grilled peppers, to be honest with you.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, I'm happy for you. More for you, less for me.
Yeah, see, I'm not going to say that I understand your take on this, but I do want you to know that I'm judging you for it.
Yeah, fair enough. calling in now on the hotline, powered by Power West Industries, is Adam Kierzenblatt, covering the Canucks and the WHL for the Hockey News. Appreciate you taking the time, Adam. How are you?
I'm good. I don't understand this grilled peppers debate either. Grilled peppers are better. The only time that you should never grill a pepper is if you're dipping it in ranch sauce or something. Like, it should always be grilled.
I don't know what it is. I think it's the texture. I couldn't tell you because I like raw peppers. So certainly, it's not a flavor thing. I don't know. I got bad taste. Maybe that's it.
Good takes, bad taste. The Josh Elliott Wolf story.
Yeah, that's me. So, Adam, right now we got the Abbotsford Canucks in the postseason. Took a 2-1 series lead over the Coachella Valley Firebirds. What have you thought of, I guess, the job Manny Malhotra and the Abbotsford Canucks as a whole have been doing in the Calder Cup playoffs so far?
Well, I think one of the big positives when you look at Manny Malhotra and his coaching style is that he's not afraid to change up his lines. He's not afraid to kind of change the game plan within the game. You know, a lot of the time at the NHL level, we ask why aren't, you know, lines being changed when stuff isn't going properly. But in the AHL, Malhotra has a very good feel and a very good, I guess, vibe of how his team is working, what his team needs. And you look at kind of the more experienced players, whether that's a Judar Kara or a Nathan Smith, like these guys have really been stepping up and kind of leading by example. And then you have all of this young talent coming through, whether that is, you know, we saw last night, Jonathan Lekromäki with an assist, Kirill Kuznetsov with a goal. Just all, it's kind of like a perfect harmony at the moment where they know what type of team they have. They knew what they needed to be doing heading into the playoffs, and it's all sort of playing out the way that they wanted to at the moment.
Of the Canucks prospects playing for Abbotsford, who do you think has boosted their stock the most across six playoff games to this point?
Well, I think even though Aturatu didn't have a ton of points, you can see just kind of the evolution of his game. He's been killer on the faceoffs. He's been really good in his defensive zone. So I think that's a positive step. But I think it's Max Sasson in the end. Like, this is somebody who was wearing the A last night for Abbotsford. He's being used in all situations. He's really stepping up, and he's showing that he can be, you know, a young leader on this team. So I think that's a big positive. And we saw Max Sasson a little bit at the end of the season. I think that's somebody who, you know, if you're looking at potential like 13th forward, fourth line players next year, I think that's somebody who's really elevated his game over this entire season and shown that, you know, he deserves maybe a longer look on that fourth line. Not necessarily he's a guarantee to be on that fourth line, but just based off of his evolution over the season and how he's been performing in the playoffs, I think that's a guy who is going to get a really long look as a fourth liner next year for the NHL club.
How big of a factor do you think, when we talk about the fourth line and 13th forward for the Vancouver Canucks next season and how Max Sasson fits into that, how important do you think the speed factor for him is? Because you look at someone like Aturatu, who's going to have a good shot next year too, obviously not the most fleet of foot. Lekromäki, not the fastest guy either. The Canucks clearly do value speed in the lineup. How beneficial do you think that's going to be for Sasson's case to make the roster in Vancouver next season?
I think when you look at players, you know, Bo Horvat is a good example. He didn't have the best skating coming out of junior, and that was something that he really worked on. And he's not the fastest player out there, but he's really good at skating, and he's really good at maneuvering. So I think with Sasson, it's going to be a something that's going to happen in the offseason. Like, if I'm the Canucks, I know that I would be looking at bringing in maybe extra skating coaches during the prospects tournament, during training camp, or even having or suggesting skating coaches to players just so that they can get that extra edge. Because you don't have to necessarily be the fastest skater in the world to be successful at the NHL level, but you need to be a good enough skater that you can move into proper positioning. And I think that's something that we'll really look at. And it also depends on where he is. So if he's a center, he doesn't necessarily need to be the fastest because he's not going to be the first one every time on the forecheck. So if you give him the speedy wingers, like a Drew O'Connor, who can get in on the forecheck, then as long as Sasson has good enough skating that he can maneuver himself into position, I think that will that could be a good situation going forward next year.
With what have you seen out of Victor Mancini over the course of this American League playoff run, and how do you think he fits on this sort of deeper reconstructed Canucks blue line?
So I've loved what I've seen from Victor Mancini. He's basically turned into Abbotsford's number one defenseman. He plays in all situations. And you can tell that physicality. You can tell that he's confident with the puck on his stick. He's making these moves that, you know, he's rushing the puck up. He's not just dumping it off to his partner, dumping it off to a forward and sitting back. He's getting in on the rush. And I would have loved to see, you know, we talk about this. I'd love to see him with Elias Pettersson at the AHL level, because I feel like that might be a tandem that we see next year, possibly the third pairing, and let them build that relationship. Obviously, that didn't happen because they didn't paper Pettersson down. But I really liked what I see from Mancini. You know, you can tell what the Canucks were looking at when they saw him in the New York Rangers system. He is a very intelligent player. He's not afraid to stick up for his teammates. He's not afraid to play that physical game. And now we're kind of seeing him in the offense more. So there's definitely an interesting package that he has of tools that can transfer to the NHL. So it's just about, can he keep up this momentum and can he keep producing in the way that he is against the NHL competition compared to a young squad in Coachella who are at the AHL level.
It is Canucks Talk. Josh Elliott Wolf, Thomas Drantz, joined by Adam Kearsenblatt, covering the Canucks and the WHL for the Hockey News. So Lekkomäki got back into last night's game. It had some complications with dental surgery, and we'll see how long this playoff run goes on for the Abbotsford Canucks. Obviously, want to see them get as far as possible, play as many games as possible. What do you want to see from Lekkomäki as long as these games continue for Abbotsford?
I think the key that you want to see from Lekkomäki is just shot volume, whether that's on the power play, whether that's at even strength. He just needs to get his shot off because he has one of the better shots on the team. You know, this is a player who has an NHL shot and can beat goaltenders. So you also want to see shot placement. You don't want to see a bunch of players, you know, or a bunch of shots just right to the chest of the goaltender. Can he pick the corners? Can he get shots in the spaces of the goaltender? And can he use screens properly? So all of these little things that kind of add up that you're going to need at the NHL level. Like, we've seen it. Players like Ilya Mikheyev was a perfect example. He had great shots, but every shot hit the goaltender in the chest. So that's not really productive. If Lekkomäki can, like I said, get shots that are high in between the gloves or the blocker and the post, or whether that's low in five-hole areas where goaltenders can't necessarily make that save, that's good. So we're not looking for, you know, 20 goals over 20 games, just basically, where is he shooting the puck? How often is he shooting the puck? Is he moving around and creating lanes? So just all of those little things that will help next season.
Artur Shelov's, by the way, lost his sort of job. I mean, he was the game one starter for the Canucks, ends the season a clear number three on the depth chart. Got pulled in game two against Coachella, but for the most part, pretty much dominant in this Calder Cup playoff run. What do you think this will mean in terms of him having an opportunity to end the season with sort of a boost in confidence and another strong performance when the chips are down at the toughest time of year?
Well, it's interesting because with Shelov, he had poor game twos, but he's had good game ones and game threes in the first two rounds. So that's kind of an interesting little trend. But I think that when you're looking at how the Canucks have set up their depth chart, you look at, obviously, Demko. We don't know necessarily what the future is, but it's clear that the team wants to keep him. You have Lankinen. So that's kind of your 1-2 for the next couple years, potentially. And then you have Ty Young, who's really taken a big step forward this year. You have Nikita Tolopilo, who the organization has to decide on because he needs a new contract. And then you have Seeloff. So it's kind of a mix of who's going to be that third goaltender for the future. Seeloff, I think, has the confidence of the coaching staff because they didn't go back to Tolopilo in game three. That kind of shows that Malhotra believes in Seeloff and kind of just need to give him a break. So I think that the longer this playoff run in the Calder Cup goes and the more strong performances Seeloff has, it's going to do a lot for his confidence, and we'll see kind of how the organization looks at it. Like, we were, forget, game one of the first round, he had that massive penalty shot save in the last minute. Like, that shows confidence. We saw what he can do at playoffs at the NHL level last year. Like, he was confident. So I think it's really a confidence thing. We have to see if he can hold up that confidence for an entire NHL season. We know that he can do it in the AHL. So, yeah, it's just a matter of what's going to happen once he gets that opportunity to be an NHL backup in Vancouver or maybe somewhere else at this point.
Adam, before we let you go, you do cover the WHL for the Hockey News as well. And the Canucks, following the lottery, officially picking 15th overall, if they keep the pick, if they do have that pick, if they do pick a 15th, is there anyone you're looking at as an intriguing option for the Canucks to take?
Well, I obviously, as carrying the WHL, I know a lot more about the WHL players than kind of the other leagues. But from a WHL perspective, there's a couple names to watch. You know, if they want to go down the center route, there's Cole Reschny, who plays in Victoria, and Brayden Kutz, who's down in Seattle right now. These are two players. Reschny is more of an offensive player. Kutz is more of that two-way forward. Both of them project as middle six centers at the NHL level. You also have Ben Kindle, who is a local kid, Lyndon Lakovic, who's local to BC. Like, so there are quite a few options. Lakovic can play center, but he's more of a winger. Kindle can play center, but he's more of a winger. So it really depends on if you're looking at the WHL. Those are four names that will most likely be available at 15 that the Canucks can pick. I mean, you know, you can't go wrong with picking a WHL kid, that's for sure.
Do you, if you had the power of choice, would you want them to make the pick, or do you think the better idea is to try to capitalize on the value and hopefully find a top six forward?
Based off where the team is right now, I think that you have to keep that 15th overall pick, because if you're bringing in a player, you know, if we're talking about Josh Norris, like, that's kind of the player that a lot of the speculation around who could be moved for the 15th pick is. Like, Norris is great. He has the connection with Quinn Hughes, but there's a lot of injury issues there. So, I mean, if you're bringing in an 17, 18-year-old who doesn't have those injury issues, who has a high ceiling and could be a, you know, top six forward for your organization for maybe 10 years rather than 5 years, I think when you're looking at a long-term situation, picking is the best option. And, you know, if it doesn't work out, you still have that prospect in the system that you can maybe move at the trade deadline if things go a certain way throughout the season. So I think keeping the 15th pick gives you more options moving forward. And also just some of the prospects that are available, I feel, can help the organization, maybe not next year, but in the next 3 to 4 years.
Hey, Adam, really appreciate you taking the time, and have a good one.
Yeah, thank you very much.
There is Adam Kierzenblatt of the Hockey News and guests on Sportsnet 650. Call in on the hotline, powered by PowerWest Industries. Don't get caught in the dark when it matters most. Visit them at powerwest.ca today. They keep the lights on. 650, 650, Dunbar Lumber text line. Keep the texts coming in. There are a lot of food texts, which is just, it's always the best. We get into May and June, especially if the Canucks aren't in the playoffs. And it's either movies or food most days on the 650, 650 Dunbar Lumber text line. You brought up cilantro. We got like three people saying cilantro is soap, which I'm sorry to those people.
Yeah, it's an enzyme, right? Like, it's not their fault. That's one food take that I don't judge, because it's literally like just your body's chemistry. Mm-hmm. You just can't enjoy cilantro like the rest of us.
And Tyler texting in, what about butter tarts? We're talking about desserts. Butter tarts, underrated.
Big butter tarts guy. Although,
Big butter.
You need to go a little further east, right? Like, one thing about Nanaimo bars is we got the Nanaimo bars down pat out in British Columbia. Our butter tart game?
Not the best?
Not the best.
What? Yeah. Where do you have to go?
Well, look, there's some good butter tarts. You know where has good butter tarts in BC, actually, is the butter tarts at, what's the farm in Pemberton called?
North Arm.
I knew you'd know it.
Yeah. Pemberton is right up Lena's alley.
North Arm Farm has really good butter tarts, but for the most part, you want to go to, like, Niagara on the Lake. You want to be in, like, pastoral, or Prince Edward County. You want to be in, like, pastoral but still well-developed Ontario, I think. Or Manitoba. There's some good butter tarts in Winnipeg, man. Winnipeg, underrated food city.
Yet another reason to go to Winnipeg.
You say underrated food city,
Underrated food city, yeah. Really good. Let's go. Really good deli.
All right.
Really good Lebanese food.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. I'm not going to Winnipeg.
This is why I produce for Thomas Strauss.
Lena is like, has been trying to pitch me on Winnipeg for as long as Canucks brunch has been a thing.
Sandy's Bakery and Gibson's, we're getting a shout out for 100%.
For butter tarts?
Yeah.
You know what? I'll have to do some research this off season. I'll come back in October and I'll be like, you know where has the best butter tart? Insert place. Maybe it's Sandy's Bakery. I don't know. I haven't done the research yet. We'll see how it goes.
I'm trying to think of the name. There's a really good bakery with sticky buns. At the ferry, where you get, like, not the ferry, but the water, maybe it's called Ruth's. Ruth's? Do you know what I'm talking about when you go to Savory Island? You ever been to Savory Island?
No.
Outside north of Powell River, like 40 minutes north of Powell River, there's a place, I think it's called Ruth's, and they do really good sticky buns. And it's right at the Nexus, or the little terminal where you grab the water taxi to go over to Savory Island. And I was there last year, and there was like a big Canadian Navy frigate out in the ocean. And I get on the water taxi to go to Savory, and I hear over the radio, like, because they're just using a public channel or whatever. And I guess some Canadian Navy men had gone to pick up sticky buns for the whole boat. Mm-hmm. You just hear over the radio, like, Operation Sticky Buns, objective acquired, right?
Sick.
And just, like, cried laughing. I was so excited to hear that.
That's awesome.
The Navy had grabbed their sticky buns.
The one thing I have to do a better job of.
Nancy's.
That's,
Lund. Lund. And Nancy's in Lund. Yeah, there you go.
The one thing I personally have to do a better job of is, like, because I used to live in Chilliwack, and so I know all the Chilliwack places. But coming out here to Vancouver, there's so many, like, local restaurants and stuff that I have to do a better job of not defaulting to the same place. I got to open my horizons this summer. That's my goal. So text in 650-650 where I should go, because I am very ill-informed and I need to expand my food palate, horizons, and just try more. So please help me out. 650-650
Sorry, what are you looking for specifically?
Honestly, anything. You know what I would love to find is a, like, great, especially in Surrey, if anyone has any suggestions, a great Mexican place.
No, that doesn't exist in British Columbia.
All right.
Sorry.
Never mind.
So
that was a quick search. It's over.
No, I mean there's honestly a lot of little Mexican spots that I like in Vancouver. It's just like, so a lot of people don't know this about me, but my stepdad is a gentleman named Miguel Almanza, who is from the south side of Chicago, but he's, like, old now. Like,
is he
he's
the,
like,
Pope?
He's like, yeah. He's very Catholic, as you can imagine. He's almost 80 now. This guy grew up, like, just to give you a sense of who he is. This guy grew up, he never used knives and forks until he joined the Air Force to fight in Korea, right? Because they just use tortillas and chips, right? Like he's that guy. And so I grew up with, like, homemade salsa and, like...
Okay. So your taste, your bar is higher than my
bar. My bar is very, very high for enjoying Mexican food, just given that, like, not only is, like, the home-cooked Mexican food I grew up with better than most restaurants, certainly outside of, like, California or Mexico, but also I can make really good Mexican food. Like, I have tamale recipes and right. salsa recipes and on and on and on.
That's not in my bag.
So I just really struggle with like going out for Mexican when I can make better enchiladas and stuff at home.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
Just is what it is.
650-650 Dunbar Lumber text line. I did want to get into this more on the other side. I may have lost it. Oh, here it is. Dave from Strathcona. What happened to Arshdeep Bains? He barely got a look this year with the big club. Thought he was, quote, NHL ready this season. So
yeah, he kind of got passed on the depth chart by guys like Sasson and Ratu and Linus Karlsson, I'd say.
Yeah, especially near the end of the year, Linus Karlsson had a good he had a call up where everybody was like, you know what, this is, we can finally see what the team is seeing in Linus Karlsson right now.
Yeah,
and Arshdeep Bains. So you had an article over the.
Like Bains' potential. I think more than most of those guys, not Ratu, but the other two. Like, I know Sasson's listed at 6'1" and like 190 pounds. There's not a big difference in terms of how he's listed versus Arshdeep Bains, but there's a big difference in terms of play strength and heaviness. And I think ultimately, you know, Sasson, like,
doesn't speed play a factor though? Because Sasson seems to be much faster.
Much faster. Well, yeah. That's that. But the problem is like down low below the hash marks, you'll notice that like larger defenders can check over Sasson's back. So it's not like about listed height. It's about like Sasson has, he's not long.
Mm-hmm.
And that inhibits his ability to protect the puck in a way that Bains doesn't deal with. I also think for all Sasson's speed, you know, he scored a goal or two off the rush, but I don't think we saw him like drive through the neutral zone on a very regular basis. That speed is more like a disruptive attribute than it is like a puck carrying attribute or an offensive attribute. He doesn't win draws. He exclusively played on the wing at the NHL level. So I just sort of worry that his upside gets capped as a guy who, it's speed in the service of defense, not speed in the service of offense. He's not a center. Unless he becomes like a really high-end penalty killer, that to me is the profile. He's not big, he's not heavy. That to me is the profile of like a 12th or 13th forward. Whereas Bain's, you know, overall productivity, they're the same age. He's outproduced him in the American League level. He's got this playmaking ability, this ability to win battles along the wall. That, you know, while his production has been completely zero at the NHL level, more or less, I still think there's a world where that can give him the sort of upside to be more like a ninth or tenth forward on a good team. So I'm keeping the light on for Arshdeep Bains, although, what, he's 24 now, he's going to be 25. Like, you know, he needs a new contract. I'd sort of expect both Sasson and Bains to be on that, like, two-year, one-way deal that mm-hmm. the Canucks like to do in terms of carving out a role or a route forward for these like fringe NHL guys. But I'm leaving the light on, I think, a little bit more for Bains. I just think there's still like an upside case for him that, you know, Linus Karlsson because of his lack of foot speed and Sasson because of his lack of size and offensive touch. I don't really see it the same way with them. So even though I think Bains had the most disappointing season, like I won't be surprised if we get into training camp and are having these conversations and like Bains is back up, you know, out competing those guys for a job.
650-650 Dunbar Lumber text line. Keep the texts coming in there. We'll get into more on the other side. It is Canucks talk. Before we go, can't find the latest episodes of your favorite HGTV Discovery and Food Network shows? Rogers Xfinity TV has the newest seasons of the top-rated shows on these popular channels, while other providers are no longer including them in their TV lineup. If your TV provider doesn't carry these channels, you're missing out on new seasons of Celebrity IOU, Hometown, Beat Bobby Flay, Expedition X, and more. Don't be fooled by other channels pretending to be these networks you know and love. Get the latest with Rogers Xfinity TV at Rogers.com. It is Canucks Talk. Josh Elliewolf, Thomas Strands on Sportsnet 650.
Just a young boy, I didn't stand a chance in hell.
Welcome back to Canucks Talk. Josh Elliott Wolf, Thomas Strands. Sportsnet 650. Coming to you live from the Kintec studio. You can text in 650-650 Dunbar Lumber text line. I love when we talk about food and people just start throwing suggestions in the text box.
It is the best.
It's wonderful. I was talking about Mexican places, and I'm from Chilliwack. We got a lot of people saying Hugo's in Chilliwack is a great place. It's my go-to. Every time I go to visit some like family in Chilliwack, I generally go to Hugo's because I love it. But it's weird because it's a solid Mexican spot in Chilliwack, which is odd. I think there's one in Langley too.
Nice.
So I would recommend it.
Yeah, I'll check it out.
Nice. 650-650 Dunbar Lumber text line. Keep the text coming in there. So before the break, we were talking about Archdeep Baines and, you know, what his role could be with the team next season. You did have an article up at The Athletic now about how Canucks top prospects fit on the NHL roster next season. And we can kind of work through the list here. But number one, with a bullet for a lot of people, is Jonathan Lekkomäki and how he fits into the Canucks roster next season.
Yeah, and I think there's a world where, you know, he could be like a 40-point middle six guy. I think what is important there is that we don't expect him to be a Brock Besser replacement, right? The truth about Brock Besser is that, you know, he can hold up with his big frame and high level of hockey intelligence in top of the lineup minutes. He can be a complimentary, you know, top of the lineup guy, which is asking a lot for like an undersized young player like Lekkomäki to do in his, you know, first full NHL season, provided that he has a strong summer and shows up to camp and competes for and wins a job. That's not where he's going to succeed. Like, that's not even fair to ask of him, right? Playing in toughs, that's a brutal assignment. Mm-hmm. Where I think Lekkomäki actually looked most NHL ready was on the power play, right? He looked Definitely. Really sharp around, you know, that sort of like left flank position that they used him in down the stretch. And I think that's an area where, again, can he replace Brock Besser on the power play? Well, no, because Brock Besser's also really good in the bumper and also really good as a screener. And Besser's down low playmaking really developed over the course of his Canucks career. So, you know, he's not going to have that same level of versatility, but as a right-handed shot who can operate smoothly, I think he can be a mainstay for the Canucks on power play one, and that would be a huge boon for him and his productivity, but also for the Canucks. Like, that's an area where I think it'll work. Lekkomäki, though, overall, he's not fast yet. He's a good skater. Technically, he's a good skater, but there's a difference between being fast and being NHL fast, and he's not NHL fast yet.
I do wonder how much, like, we all know he has to have a big summer, get bigger, gain some muscle. I wonder how far that goes in gaining speed, because usually there's a sweet spot where you're like, sometimes you get too big. I don't think Lekkomäki's going to get too big and lose a step or not gain as much of a step as he could. But there is a balance where, like, hey, you can gain some muscle, and with that, you gain some speed as well. I'm interested in seeing how his offseason goes, and he's probably the guy I'm most interested in seeing how he comes back in training camp and like what kind of shape he's in, how NHL ready he is now that he has NHL experience.
Yeah, look, he needs to add a lot of strength, because it's not just that he needs to add core strength, like functional core strength to allow him to be NHL fast, but he also, like, I can't think of a battle that he won along the wall or below the hash marks. Like, I can't think of one.
Mm-hmm.
I'm serious. I'm thinking about it. I'm trying to like remember a moment. And it's not for a lack of competitiveness. Like, he brings fire in those engagements. But, like, think about what it looks like when Nils Höglander or Connor Garland is up against a bigger opponent on the wall, and how they cut back and how they use sort of the advantages of their low center of gravity to protect the puck. And think about what it looks like with with Lekkomäki. World's different, right? Like, to survive and play a big role at his frame. And I know, again, just, like, do not rely on hockey listings, because I think he's listed at like 5'11 and like 170 pounds or whatever, and the weight might be right, but the height is not. As a smaller player, if you're going to exist in a big minute role in the NHL, like, you need to be able to win those battles, protect the puck. You need to be able to come out of those engagements with the puck, especially if you're going to play with top guys who need to maximize their touches to have, you know, a winning impact. So, again, I think Lekkerimäki made a pretty strong case down the stretch. I don't know if his role would have been even that large if the Canucks had kept Tocchet, to be totally honest with you. I think the coaching change might benefit Lekkerimäki. But I think management was pretty happy about some of the flashes that they saw in his overall performance in his first North American professional season. And I think he's got a real case to play like a middle six offensive spark plug role for this team next season. But he's going to need to add a lot of strength, I think, to even have success doing that. And certainly if he's going to level up and be more than that, which he certainly has the potential to be. I kind of look at Matthew Coronato as like what we should hope to see from Lekkerimäki next season. Like, a Coronado type season for me would be him remaining on track as a guy with potential to be like a star or top of the lineup contributor. And for Coronado, who obviously signed a huge deal, you know, he had 9 points in 34 NHL games in 2023-24. That's like not dissimilar from what Lekkerimäki did, right? I mean, it's maybe slightly more impressive, but it's certainly in the same ballpark. You know, we saw Lekkerimäki have some moments. He had 6 points in 24 games, so can't get too much more similar. And he was just over a point per game in the American League with 15 goals. You know, Lekkerimäki was under a point per game, but had like more goals than that in fewer games in the American League. So I think that's like a good comp. His season, 77 games, 24 goals, 23 assists, 47 total points. Like, I think if Lekkerimäki can get close to that 40-ish points, middle six deployment, spend the whole year in the American League, that would represent real progress for Lekkerimäki and be a boon for the Canucks. They still need three more top six forwards, though.
Yes. Yeah. Before we get into the top six forwards, we slightly spoke about it off the top of the show, but another Canucks prospect, Tom Elander, a lot up in the air for his summer right now and his offseason. There were reports from Rick Dhaliwal on Donnie and Dolly today regarding Tom Elander and his future, saying that his advisor, Todd Diamond, going over to Sweden to speak with Tom Elander, present him with his options. Dhaliwal saying he's not hearing the Canucks are close to signing Tom Elander. So I assume the options that he'll be presented with are some European teams that are going to be interested in signing him to play in Sweden, and also, of course, what the Canucks are offering, and if he changes his mind about accepting whatever it is the Canucks are offering to Tom Elander.
Yep. Yeah, so Tom Elander is going to make a decision here, whether or not they just sort of take it on the chin and sign the best offer that the Canucks are willing to make, because the Canucks are not going to bend on their entry-level structure for anybody, including Tom. And I think that's been made clear at this point. If he's going to go back to school or if he's going to play in Sweden, we're talking about him being years away from getting, you know, the right to be an unrestricted free agent or anything like that, multiple years. So, you know, you either make a lot less money and take out a big insurance policy, or you sign with us and this is what that looks like and this is the best we can do. And sounds like, you know, if Diamond and the Elander family are meeting to discuss their options, then it sounds like this is coming to a head one way or the other. And the question is what Elander will do, right? Do you make millions and come in and, you know, try to make the Canucks out of camp, which, by the way, the organization thinks he can do. Like, the organization wants Tom Elander to be in their lineup next year. They believe that he can help them win at the NHL level next season. They believe that he could help them win in the at the NHL level down the stretch this season. Like, that, you know, there's no question about in the organization about his ability and his ability to make the team. There is, however, a desire to do things a certain way in terms of what entry-level contracts look like, in terms of what second contracts look like. And, you know, they're not going to jettison that framework. That's what the holdup has been. It's been bizarre. Like, I don't understand why they couldn't sell this to the guy. That's what sort of I come back to is not that, like, I have a problem with the Canucks sort of, you know, I don't want to use a term like nickel and diming. I don't have a problem with a team carving out a unique way of doing business as it pertains to player development, right? And sometimes when you're setting these precedents, right? Building this pathway through your organization, you're going to crack some eggs and it's going to look silly from the outside. I'll give you a couple examples. When the Canucks under Mike Gillis took the Sedin twins to the 11th hour, ultimately flying to Stockholm to meet them at the airport to get a last minute deal and spoiling Brian Burke's dream of poaching them, Brian Burke landing at the airport in Frankfurt and turning around, seeing the news that the Canucks had got the deal done. Like, that was a huge risk, a huge dice roll. There were moments along the process, including the scheduling the visit to Sweden, was like mostly done as a PR stunt. Like, hey, we can't let these guys walk without being able to look at our fans and say, we've done everything possible to try and sign them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they ended up getting a deal done, but by playing hardball, they set up an internal cap structure that then resulted in Luongo coming in at 5.3, yes, forever, but and his contract sucked according to him. But nonetheless, yeah. At 5.3, which was a huge steal relative to sort of that team's competitive window. And Kessler coming in at 5, which was a massive steal. And, you know, on and on down the line, right? A ton of winning deals, Ham Hughes, Bieksa, that the organization was able to impose because they set that structure up. The Tampa Bay Lightning and their sort of bridge contract structure was built by having Kucherov. They grinded out Kucherov, literally the best Lightning player in franchise history, I think it's fair to say, to the point where he was holding out of camp and considering offer sheet opportunities with other teams.
Yeah.
Like that went to the absolute death, and they got Kucherov done. And then what happened? They had the Vasilevsky bridge, the Braden Point bridge. They won cups on those bridge contracts. Then the Cernak bridge, the Sorelli bridge. I mean, they maintained 7 years of excellence and won 2 Stanley Cups and made it to 3 Stanley Cup finals on the backs of that contractual structure that required some ugliness to establish. Canucks are willing to court some ugliness to set this up. Now, is it worth it? Is it a little bit old school? Does it matter? I don't know. I don't know, because I'm not someone who has experience running a hockey team and like building an organizational culture and on and on. It looks a little silly to me from the outside, but it would, wouldn't it? Like, that's sort of the point. I don't have the recipe. I don't have the instructions.
The thing I will say is, like, all the examples you mentioned are guys that aren't on their rookie deal, right? Like, we're talking about a rookie deal here where there are built-in limits to how much someone can earn. And that's why I think when Canucks fans look at this, it's like, hey, if you're trying to play hardball with someone who is looking for their second contract, or for Brock Besser, for example, where it's like, hey, this guy's looking for an extension that is going to pay him into his 30s, that I think fans will be completely understandable about. And they will get on board with it, try to, you know, set a firm line in the sand and stick to your guns when it comes to that. When it comes to a entry-level contract, even if you as management look at it and go, hey, you know, we have a line in the sand, this is something we are firm about, I think it's difficult for fans to look at it and say, hey, I understand why you're doing this. Because, again, there are built-in limits with how much a rookie can earn regardless.
Yeah, I just don't understand why you can't sell the vision. Like, why could they not sell the vision to this guy? Now, you know, Volander's dad's a skills coach, right? They're deeply embedded in the hockey community in Sweden. This is a kid with options, and he seems to be wired a little bit differently. He seems to be a bit of an individual, and not in a negative way. Not in a, like, oh, it's a problem. Like, just in a, his options and his vistas seem to be a little bit wider than average. So maybe the family decides to be stubborn enough to dig their heels in and you know, see if the Canucks fold in a year or a year and a half. Right. I mean, at some point, the leverage will shift to them dramatically. At some point, every player's rights expire and they have the right to either re-enter the draft or be free agents. So it's just that there's a lot of missed opportunity in that. Right. There's a lot of years lost.
You have a lot of patience to be able to.
You have to have a lot of patience. You have to stay healthy. You lose out on some critical development time. Like, this is a guy who could have an NHL job in October. And in fact, will have an inside track at an NHL job in October if he signs. Like, that should be compelling. Mm-hmm. Why can't you sell this vision? That to me is the only thing that is really bizarre about this. I don't have a problem with an organization trying to design their own sort of NHL player development pathways. And in fact, I think the Canucks have done a lot of work to establish what theirs looks like. It's why we know sort of what Ratu's next contract looks like. Like, we know that Ratu's next contract, barring an offer sheet, is going to be 2 times $900K one-way deal.
Yeah.
Like, we know that. We know he's going to get qualified, and then they're going to offer the one-way deal to restrain the cap hit. And if he continues to perform well, what are they going to do? They're going to sign an extension for him early, just like they did with Hoglander.
Yeah.
Because it's not just Hoglander who signed this type of contract. It's Podkolzin. It's Jack Rathbone. It's Akito Hirose. It's, like, there's guys who didn't amount to anything. But the way that they look at it is, like, when you're right on the fringes of the NHL and we believe in you, this is what that deal looks like. This is what that second contract looks like. And your third contract will get done early if you stay on this path and, you know, have a great summer and report to camp in shape and make your case, which is what Nils Hoglander did and got rewarded for. And you know, I have no issue with a team trying to carve out this sort of path for their players, even if, you know, we are at a point where, like, the Coronado bet to me is how teams are going to have to start thinking about this. Like, I guess my one concern about this from a Canucks perspective is I think you have to start betting big and early on guys, because mm-hmm. if the cap's going to go up 10% every year, or 7% every year, then every time you kick the can down the road to committing to a guy, they're signing into a new revamped higher marketplace. And mm-hmm. I think you're best off to try and lock in cost certainty as much as possible, especially with those guys you really believe in.
It's definitely going to be that feels like the shift we're going to see in the league is, like, teams,
we have to.
Yeah. Teams trying to get that deal done early and get the cap number at a reasonable deal. You brought up Atu Ratu, and he was one of the players in your article at The Athletic as well. What do you expect from him? Like, what do you want to see from him next season, I guess? Like, positionally in the lineup and how he plays next season?
Well, he needs to keep adding to that skating stride. I think he's now, like, he used to be, like, four steps away from being a full-time NHL centerman. Now I think he's, like, one, maybe one and a half. Add one more, and I think we're starting to cook with a guy who I think would have, you know, top nine center upside, real top nine center upside. I thought there were some really nice things he did, especially operating in traffic as a skill player. Obviously, winning draws was excellent. I thought he drove play decently well too, although he's going to need the right types of line mates to play alongside. My expectations for Atu Ratu are going to be determined largely by what else the team does at center, because we know that they want a top nine center. So, and obviously they've got Teddy Bluger, and Pew Suter maybe resigns, probably not, but maybe. And so we sort of look at it and think, like, where is Ratu's spot in this lineup? And where I sort of keep coming back to is, you know, how sure are we that the club won't consider including Teddy Bluger and some of the packages that they might need to put together to acquire the sort of centerman they want or top six winger they want? Like, Bluger would be very marketable given his penalty killing excellence, given his faceoff winning, given just, like, his championship pedigree, right? The experience that he has as a great team guy would save the team an additional $2 million. Like, I'm still looking at that as being, or, like, Ratu's upside case to me feels pretty contingent on what does the club do in terms of adding a top nine centerman or top two line centerman, and what does the club do in terms of Teddy Bluger and his Canucks future. And I think if Bluger is dealt, then we know pretty much that Ratu's going to be the fourth line center, right? And if he's not, then I don't know where Ratu fits. He feels like a first call up type. But his entry-level deal expired. I'd have to check, but he's going to be waiver eligible real soon, if not next year. So, you know, you probably then you're talking about a 13th forward. Do you move him to the wing? I like him on the wing. Like, I have no problem with that. So I just look at that Bluger, like, the Ratu development to me feels really linked to what the Canucks decide to do further up the lineup at center and in terms of Teddy Bluger. I know that Bluger has been, like, a great soldier and represents a lot of what this club wants culturally in the room. And yet I can't shake the suspicion that he might be a guy that the Canucks look to move on from potentially to sort of vacate a spot for Ratu to move into next year.
The one thing I do wonder too is, like, if you bring Suter back, we talk about how versatile he is. He could be a winger, right?
Like, I mean, I think you're making a mistake if you bring Pew Suter back to be a top, like,
a middle six center.
Yeah, I don't think you bring. I think anyone signing Pew Suter with the idea that you're signing a middle six center is missing the point. Mm-hmm. I think the point of Pew Suter is to be Ben Zobrist.
Yeah, that's a great comparable. Yes,
you're signing like a guy you want to be the sixth or seventh best forward on your team, capable of literally playing any spot 1 through 12 and elevating whatever line he's on because he's so smart defensively, although there are significant limitations in terms of his speed and size. But, you know, he's a goal scorer who defends well and is always in the right position and can play anywhere in your lineup. Like, I don't know, man. I have no qualms with, like, if a team goes out there and pays $4.5 to $5 million a year for Pew Suter, mm-hmm. provided that they're not counting on him to be a second line center, I think that's going to be fine. He's going to raise your floor. He's going to be able to play top line for you if you need it. He's going to be able to play second line for you if you need it. Left wing, right wing, center, penalty kill, power play, whatever you need. Whatever you need, Pew Suter can do it. I mean, I like Pew Suter as an ad for anybody. I would like if the Canucks kept him. I just think he's not the answer to the what do the Canucks do at second line center question. He's the answer to a different question than that entirely.
I would agree. And before we go, did want to mention some news around the league. As teams get eliminated from playoff contention, they do their end of season media availabilities. The Devils did theirs today. GM Tom Fitzgerald, a couple quotes from him saying, "We won't be coming back with the same group. I can tell you that because it was not good enough." And I, as an eternal optimist,
The Hughes brothers are coming here.
The Hughes brothers are coming back to Vancouver, or coming to Vancouver, reunited in Vancouver. This all means Jack Hughes is available. He also said about Jack Hughes that But basically saying he expects him to come back. He had a shoulder surgery and expects him to come back in good shape. We'll see what happens with Jack Hughes and his health going into next season. But the Devils would be an interesting option outside of Jack Hughes to see who they make available this offseason and if someone on that roster would fit for the Vancouver Canucks. Dawson Mercer always feels like a name that comes up when we're talking about the Devils making changes. I don't know if I'd be super into him and interested.
Oh, I love Dawson Mercer. Great player.
I think he's fine.
I think he's got more than he's shown. But, yeah, I mean, I like Dawson Mercer a lot. He's got a lot of dog in him. But, yeah, I mean, look, I think the truth is that if the Canucks and the New Jersey Devils at any point start talking mega trade over the next 14 months, I don't think Canucks fans are going to like it.
Well,
unless, you know what I mean? Like, yeah. let's be real.
It's the other way, but yeah,
I feel like you're opening Pandora's box.
Fair.
Yeah.
Tom Fitzgerald also saying he thinks offer sheets will be more prevalent league-wide this offseason. Fun.
I think the Canucks expect that too. And we'll sort of see if they decide to use that as a weapon. I think their preliminary thinking, which obviously subject to change based on like off-season strategy meetings with all of their hockey operations staff, but their Canucks hockey operations leadership's preliminary thinking on offer sheets was that it probably didn't make sense for this team in their position, but not to rule it out. Just saying, I'd be a little bit surprised if the Canucks were to be heavy players in that market.
It definitely wouldn't be surprising if we see other teams around the league, though, look at it after Holloway and Broberg, and they're like, great idea.
Especially the Chicago's and San Jose's and those teams that have like $40 million in cap space.
Mm-hmm. Appreciate everyone texting in, 650-650, Dunbar Lumber text line. That's going to do it for the show today. Thank you to everyone listening as well. Thank you to intern Kieran. Thank you to Lena. Thank you to my co-host, Thomas Drance. I've been Josh Elliott-Wolf. This has been Canucks Talk on Sportsnet 650.